From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
A former Walmart security worker fired by the company for taping a reporter tells a very sophisticated and well-equipped security operation the company ran from its Bentonville headquarters.
Watching the watchdogs, a former Walmart worker blows the whistle on Walmart's threat research and analysis group. He says the retail giant spied on employees, journalists, stockholders, and critics of the company. We'll speak with the Wall Street Journal reporter who broke the story and the spokesperson for Walmart Watch who was monitored himself. Then is sickness a crime? A man infected with tuberculosis is jailed in Arizona. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A newly declassified report from the Pentagon's Inspector General concludes Saddam Hussein was not directly cooperating with al-Qaeda before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, despite claims by the Bush administration. The Pentagon's report is based in part on captured Iraqi documents and interrogations of Saddam Hussein and two former aides. The declassified report reveals the CIA had concluded as early as June 2002 there were few substantiated contacts between al-Qaeda operatives and Iraqi officials. However, top Bush administration officials ignored the CIA's findings. In September 2002, Pentagon official Douglas Feith asserted the relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda was mature and symbiotic. Feith's comments came in a briefing to Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. Feith also suggested Iraq might have been involved in 9/11 and other al-Qaeda attacks. Despite the Pentagon's new report, Vice President Cheney is still claiming there were ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda. He appeared on Rush Limbaugh's radio program yesterday and claimed al-Qaeda was operating inside Iraq before the U.S. invasion. NBC News is reporting the Pentagon's preparing to send an additional 12,000 National Guard soldiers to Iraq and Afghanistan. Defense Secretary Robert Gates held a news conference Thursday, but he did not mention the Guard deployment. Earlier this year, Gates revised Pentagon regulations to authorize more frequent Guard deployments to take some of the burden off the Army. In Iraq, 8 U.S. soldiers and 4 British troops have died over the past 2 days in what's been described as one of the bloodiest 48-hour periods for coalition forces in recent months. On Thursday, at least 49 Iraqis were also killed in shootings, bombings, and mortar attacks across the country. Earlier today, at least 27 people were killed in a suicide bombing in the city of Ramadi. British Prime Minister Tony Blair suggested yesterday's attack on British troops could have been carried out by elements linked to Iran.
Now it is far too early to say that the particular terrorist act that killed our forces was an act committed by terrorists who were backed by any elements of the Iranian regime. So I make no allegation in respect of that particular incident, but the general picture, as I've said before, is that there are elements, at least, of the Iranian regime that are backing, financing, arming, supporting terrorism in Iraq.
Meanwhile, in Baghdad, police have found the body of a famous television anchor named Kamal Khalaf. She was kidnapped 2 days ago. A truck bomb also exploded outside a Sunni TV station in Baghdad. The blast took the station off the air and killed the station's assistant director. 12 other people were wounded. The Christian Science Monitor is reporting the number of Iraqis being detained by the United States is skyrocketing. Under the new Baghdad security plan, the U.S. is apprehending thousands of Iraqis. Before the beginning of the so-called surge, the U.S. was holding 13,000 Iraqis. Now 18,000 Iraqis are being held, and Army General David Petraeus is making plans to be able to hold up to 40,000 Iraqis in coming months. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the U.S. will hold many of these detainees indefinitely. To help staff the expanding jails, the Pentagon announced Monday the deployment of more than 2,000 additional U.S. military police to Iraq. In other news from the Middle East, the British TV network Sky News has revealed new information about the 15 freed British sailors and Marines who were held by Iran. days before the sailors were seized by Iran. The captain of the ship told Sky News that part of his team's mission in the Persian Gulf was to gather intelligence on the Iranians. Sky News withheld the information until the release of the sailors. British Defense Secretary Des Brown defended the intelligence operation. Brown said it was important to gather intelligence to, quote, keep our people safe. A new United Nations report on climate change warns global warming could cause more shortages of food in Africa, more severe weather events in Europe and the United States, the decimation of coral reefs, and the disappearance of the ice caps. The report is being released today at a major conference on global warming in Brussels. Experts said the poorest people in the world will be hardest hit by the effects of climate change. This is Australian scientist Roger Jones.
The two biggest risks, areas of risk for impacts are the biodiversity and water. And in amongst that we see lots of other vulnerabilities. Some low-lying areas are vulnerable to sea level rise and to extreme events, of course, and in particular drought and fire, I think, are some of the two biggest risks that we see.
The report was written by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which groups the work of 2,500 scientists from around the world. This is UN Undersecretary General Achim Steiner.
Well, I think we today know that the series of impacts that are associated with climate change cannot be isolated in terms of one phenomenon or another. A warmer winter may be one phenomenon that we will observe, but in fact, also in the richer countries, in Europe and North America, we will see other effects that are associated with this, more extreme weather events, floods. These are all impacts that are part of the reality of living with climate change.
Meanwhile, a new study in the journal Science is predicting rising temperatures here in this country will likely result in a permanent drought throughout Arizona and the Southwest by the year 2050. Scientists say the drought could result in conditions not seen since the 1930s Dust Bowl. Back in Brussels, the World Wildlife Fund called for governments to take action to stop global warming. This is Hans Verholm, the director of the WWF's Global Climate Change Program.
So what we're looking for and what we're trying to secure is a commitment to reduce emissions from the rich 30% by 2020. And we were very encouraged a few weeks ago when the European heads of state reached a tentative agreement that if the rest of the world does their fair share, Europe will do what is necessary, that is, a minus 30% reduction by 2020.
Officials in Florida have voted to make it possible for ex-felons in the state to regain their voting and other civil rights after completing their sentences. Over 950,000 residents of Florida have been denied the right to vote because of past felony convictions. The American Civil Liberties Union criticized the state for failing to automatically restore the voting rights of all ex-offenders. People who previously completed sentences will have to apply on their own. The ACLU says the new rules are needlessly complex and will only confuse and deter potential applicants. Amnesty International says conditions at Guantanamo Bay are deteriorating. The group estimates 80% of prisoners are now being held in solitary confinement. In December, the U.S. opened a new facility at the base known as Camp 6, where prisoners are held in conditions of extreme isolation and sensory deprivation. Prisoners are reportedly confined for 22 hours a day in windowless cells where they're almost completely cut off from human contact. Prisoners are often only offered exercise at night and may not see daylight for days at a time. Amnesty says even men who've been cleared for release are being held in isolation. The Guardian newspaper reports the Bush administration has admitted openly for the first time it's actively working to undermine Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe. A new U.S. State Department report acknowledged the U.S. is supporting opposition politicians in the country and others critical of Mugabe. The State Department also admitted sponsoring events aimed at discrediting statements made by Mugabe's government. Mugabe has led Zimbabwe since 1980 when it became an independent nation. In New York, a jazz musician has pleaded guilty in a controversial terrorism case. Tariq Shah, who has played bass with Abby Lincoln, Betty Carter, and others, was arrested 2 years ago following an undercover FBI sting operation. Prosecutors accused Shah of plotting to teach martial arts to would-be al-Qaeda operatives. The case was based on statements he made to a government informant. If Shah had been found guilty by a jury, he could have faced up to 30 years in prison, even though the government admits he had never committed any violent acts. On Wednesday, after 23 months in solitary confinement, Shah accepted an offer by the government to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy to provide material support to a terrorist organization. In exchange, he'll receive a sentence of no more than 15 years. The Associated Press has reportedly fired a Mexican correspondent named Rebecca Romero due to her pro-government bias in her coverage of last year's populist uprising in Oaxaca. This according to a report on the website Narco News. In January, Narco News revealed that Romero had violated the AP's code of ethics by accepting payments from the Oaxacan state government for advertisements on her personal website. Before her stint at the Associated Press, Romero had worked as a press secretary for the Mexican Federal Attorney General. For much of the conflict in Oaxaca, U.S. newspapers relied solely on the Associated Press articles written by Romero. A review of Romero's coverage by Narco News showed a consistent pattern of sensationalizing protester violence while sanitizing state violence through misreporting. Romero never published a single article that attempted to explain the protesters' motivations. A play featuring the writings of the late American peace activist Rachel Corrie has been silenced for the third time in just over a year. The Mosaic Theater in Miami has announced it's canceled My Name is Rachel Corrie after protests from some of the theater's subscribers and outside individuals. Corrie was the 23-year-old American activist who was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza on March 16, 2003. Last year, both the New York Theater Workshop and the Canadian theater company CanStage pulled productions of the play. A prominent Israeli historian has announced he's moving to Britain because he's found it increasingly difficult to keep living in Israel. Ilan Pape is a senior lecturer at the University of Haifa and a vocal critic of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. Professor Pape says he receives threatening phone calls every day and that there have been attempts to expel him from the university. In Britain, Pape will teach at Exeter University. Meanwhile, here in this country, one of academia's most prominent critics of Israel, Norman Finkelstein, is facing an uphill battle to receive tenure at DePaul University, where he has taught for the last 6 years. His tenure has been approved at the departmental and college level, but the dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences has opposed it. A final decision is expected to be made by May. Finkelstein has accused Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz of being responsible for leading the effort to deny him tenure. In an interview with the Harvard Crimson, Dershowitz admitted he'd sent a letter to DePaul faculty members lobbying against Finkelstein's tenure. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Those are the headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. Watching the watchdogs. A former worker at Walmart is claiming the retail giant is running a sophisticated surveillance operation that targets employees, journalists, stockholders, and critics. Bruce Gabbard was fired last month for intercepting and recording phone calls to and from a New York Times reporter. Gabbard told the Wall Street Journal he was part of a broader surveillance operation run out of Walmart's Arkansas headquarters. Employees reportedly nicknamed their work area the Bat Cave. Gabbard also revealed Walmart infiltrated the group up against the wall last year by sending a long-haired employee wearing a wireless microphone to one of the group's meetings. A Walmart surveillance van was stationed outside the meeting in order to listen in to what was happening. Walmart also reportedly closely monitored the internet and phone usage of employees at work. Managers receive a list of email addresses and phone numbers with which their employees have communicated, and a list of websites visited. Walmart also developed a system to read the personal emails of workers sent or received from private accounts such as Hotmail or Gmail. After the Wall Street Journal story ran, Walmart issued an apology, but only to shareholders that were monitored under the surveillance operation. In a few minutes, we're going to speak with an activist who was targeted by the surveillance. But first, we're joined by one of the two reporters who broke the story. Gary McWilliams is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us from a studio in Houston. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gary.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, why don't you lay out the story first? How did you discover what Walmart was doing?
Well, it was about 5 weeks ago the company announced it had fired a technician for recording conversations with a New York Times reporter and with recording pager messages sent over its internal network. We started looking into it then, and what we found was a very sophisticated, very extensive operation run by former FBI agents and headed by a former CIA agent in his Bentonville headquarters. Mr. Gabbard spoke with us, described the operation in quite detail, and helped draw a picture, really, of a company that had an executive security program, global security, threat protection, information security, quite extensive operation.
Talk about the man who became the whistleblower.
Mr. Gabbard's a former Marine. He was a reserve deputy sheriff in Benton County, outside of that encompasses Bentonville. But, you know, the interesting part, this goes back to post 9/11. What he described to us was, at that time, some FBI had set up a program asking U.S. corporations to look for terrorist cells using their phone systems to record calls from places like Syria, Iran, North Korea. And Mr. Gabbard helped set that system up. And in the wake, several years later, that same system was used to record calls from a reporter.
Explain the first part. How did he monitor these calls to these other countries?
Well, they set up a system with their PBX, internal telephone system, that would look for phone numbers coming from rogue countries, essentially, to them, and then record those calls, looking for sleeper cells, perhaps, within their workforce or for terrorists calling in. And now this sort of security operation took on a second wind about 2 or 3 years ago when embarrassing memos started appearing on Walmart Watch's website. And those sort of triggered a new round of looking for information leakers inside the company. And they use, again, a very sophisticated email snooping system to look for keywords and messages going outside the company.
You write in the piece in the Wall Street Journal that Mr. Gabbard says he was directed by two former FBI agents working for Walmart who set up this system to monitor foreign calls originally.
Right. Like a lot of companies, after 9/11, Walmart took a look at its security systems and decided it needed to sort of beef them up. And what we saw from them was a very sophisticated ramp-up of people and equipment.
And where did Pentagon technology fit into the story?
It's very interesting. You know, a lot of corporations have systems that filter emails. They look for keywords that suggest wrongdoing. What Walmart did was acquire a system used primarily in the past by the Defense Department that was much more sophisticated. It could do things such as tell the degree of flesh tone on an image that was viewed. It could look at all content going over its corporate network. And where typical email monitoring systems would look at the corporate email system, you know, your internal network, what this system was able to do was look at any content passing. So if you accessed a Gmail system, for instance, it could see what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm. And you write the whole issue of flesh tones has to also do with whether people are viewing pornography.
Correct. You know, most companies have a system to prevent harassment. And prevent wrongdoing by employees, but this is fairly advanced. I think we spoke with a head of a information security network that said it was quite above what most companies have.
You also write that Walmart helped the Pentagon develop technology.
Well, exactly. This system was not helping the Pentagon. What it was helping a software developer perfect the system. We mentioned the system was used primarily by the Defense Department. Walmart was helping develop a commercial version.
Oakley Networks, what is this company?
It's a Utah software company that provides a software package called CoreView that looks at information going over a network, and it's so sophisticated it allows essentially to replay later exactly what an employee would have seen on his screen or done with his computer.
And monitors
They describe it as sort of a TiVo-like replay.
Monitoring keystrokes.
At one level, yes. But again, think of it as a TiVo player where you can replay activities, you know, done in the past. This is quite the same way. They can replay your computer screen to show exactly what you were seeing and changes you were making to it.
The well-known multinational company McKinsey, where does it play in here?
Well, at one point, you know, one of these embarrassing memos that Walmart felt had been leaked from internally McKinsey had helped work on that memo. It was their Susan Chambers healthcare memo, if you recall it. Subsequent to
explain
that,
explain what the Susan Chambers memo was.
It was an internal document sent to the board of directors proposing ways to reduce their health care costs. Among those, was requiring employees to do more physical chores to essentially weed out those that were sickly, unhealthy, and therefore cut their health care costs.
So go on and with your point.
The company was embarrassed by this, obviously, and there was a stream of other memos that started leaking out after 2005. And Mr. Gabbard tells us, he was approached by the head of security to help stop those leaks. And he used the Oakley system essentially to monitor internet access by McKinsey consultants doing a later project.
We're talking to Gary McWilliams, one of the two Wall Street Journal reporters who broke the story on, the headline, Inside Walmart's, quote, threat research operation. So tell us what happened to Mr. Gabbard, to the whistleblower who worked for some 19 years, how exactly this whole thing unraveled and came to be known.
Mr. Gabbard was fired a little more than a month ago as a result of another employee, I guess, going forward and saying that he felt there was something wrong here and taping the New York Times reporters.
That was Michael Barbaro,
calls into the company.
The New
Correct.
York Times reporter.
Correct. And as a result of they did a month-long investigation of the activities, and he was dismissed thereafter. Now, we spoke with Mr. Gabbard because he felt the company had misportrayed his activities. They portrayed him as a rogue employee when, in fact, he felt quite a bit of what he was doing was sanctioned by higher-ups. And, in fact, he was pressured into stopping those leaks by higher-ups in the company.
In a moment, we're going to be speaking with New Wexler, who is a spokesperson for Walmart Watch, a group that is critical of Walmart. But tell us his story.
Mr. Wexler, I think, was attempting to visit with reporters attending a Walmart media event a couple of years ago. And what Mr. Gabbard tells us was the security group was looking for a ways of identifying him if he showed up at that meeting. And so Mr. Gabbard went out on the web searching for information on Mr. Wexler and found a blog he had written for the South Carolina Democratic Party, rummaged through that South Carolina computer and found a folder containing Mr. Wexler's vacation photos. And he used those to access and provide them to Walmart corporate security to identify Mr. Wexler when he showed up.
A Walmart spokesperson declined our request for an interview, but did issue a statement in response to Gabbard's accusations. Walmart says, quote, this group is no longer operating in the same manner that it did prior to the discovery of the unauthorized recording of telephone conversations. There have been changes in leadership, and we have strengthened our practices and protocols in this area. Mr. Gabbard and another associate were terminated for their actions of unauthorized recordings of telephone conversations and interception of text messages, and the company self-reported the incident after learning of the phone recordings and interception of text messages situation. Like most major corporations, it is our corporate responsibility to have systems in place, including software systems, to monitor threats to our network, intellectual property, and our people. These situations are limited to cases which are high risk to the company or our associates, such as criminal fraud or security issues. Can you respond to this, Gary McWilliams?
No. I mean, Walmart issued that statement, I think, recently after our story appeared, and they issued a statement a month ago when Mr. Gabbard was terminated. But essentially, their original statement said that he had violated common practice at the company. Mr. Gabbard maintains there was no policy that prevented him from recording those calls. And in fact, he had been urged post 9/11 to record calls and look for keywords. So I'll leave it to Walmart to decide.
You also talk about Walmart monitoring shareholders. Explain.
Yeah, it was a fairly uncommon practice from what we've seen to look at shareholders who submitted resolutions for the annual meeting. And in this year, what we saw was that the company took those list of shareholders who presented petitions and sent it to their security group to do a, quote, threat assessment of these people for their potential to disrupt the annual meeting if their petitions were refused. And you know, we spoke with Dr. Sidney Kay, an 85-year-old retired science teacher, you know, who was among those looked at. And Mr. Kay says, I'm a nobody. Why would they want to look at me?
Overall, you did talk to corporate practices people. How common is this behavior on the part of a corporation?
For some things are very common. I mean, most Americans are told if you're using your corporate email system, you know, the law has upheld the right of the company to look at that email. And there are just dozens of software packages that do things like filtering, web filtering to look at what you're looking at over the internet, you know, tracking the URL address, for instance. And companies are allowed to look at your email used on the corporate system. Typically, what they don't do, though, is, you know, track your access to, say, Yahoo Mail or Hotmail or Gmail.
And finally, the issue of Walmart infiltrating an anti-Walmart group up against the wall, that's WAL. What did you learn about that?
What Mr. Gabbard had told us was, you know, the company had become concerned that that group had protested at one of its managers' meetings, and it had read on internet sites that it was planning on going to its shareholder meeting last year and potentially going with Acorn. And that concerned them. They wanted to find out about that. And so they ended up sending an employee to a protest group to find out what might be going on, whether Acorn and Up Against the Wall were joining forces. But it was fairly sophisticated. Again, you know, the employee had a wireless microphone. Mr. Gabbard said he rode around in the company's surveillance van to listen to what was going on and make sure the employee was protected. And then they used the information later to alert the local police department about the protesters' plans.
And so the infiltrator, the long-haired infiltrator, went into a meeting and the van was outside monitoring because the infiltrator was wearing a microphone?
Essentially, it was outdoors. I mean, they were. I think they actually recorded a protest group in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and the employee ended up joining the protest march down the street.
You know, it strikes me that years ago, Ralph Nader really began his purges with money that he got from General Motors because it was exposed that they were monitoring and surveilling him.
I'm not familiar with that. But, you know, you have to understand that anytime you're in a public place, anyone can monitor you. They can take your picture. They can follow you as long as it doesn't cross a line to harassment. And the same thing with, we talked about, the, you know, the courts have upheld the use of, the legality of a company looking at email on a corporate network.
Well, Gary,
Walmart has quite strict policies. I'll just go on. You know, they tell their employees any use of company computers or phones could be monitored. They also limit what their employees can look at on the internet. They're fairly restrictive in that regard.
Well, Gary McWilliams, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Wall Street Journal reporter joining us from Houston. Broke the story inside Walmart's threat research operation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll talk to one of the subjects of Walmart's surveillance. Stay with us.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. And their speech is growing. Running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland. Pay. They'll fight like hell
Iris Dement, Wasteland of the Free, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at Walmart's newly exposed surveillance operation, my next guest is a Walmart critic who ended up on Walmart's watch list. New Wexler is a spokesperson for the group Walmart Watch. According to the Wall Street Journal expose, Walmart used pictures found on the internet to track news plans to attend Walmart's annual meeting. New Wexler joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome, New.
Hi, thanks for having me on today, Amy.
So tell us what you learned about, well, yourself through Walmart's eyes.
Well, I mean, it was, as Gary mentioned earlier on the show, I had attended a Walmart media conference in Arkansas. It was last spring. And it's a public event that Walmart held at the Embassy Suites Hotel, not too far from their corporate headquarters in Bentonville. It was, some events were closed, some events were closed to the public, open to media only, and we had no intentions of going into those events, certainly didn't intend to disrupt anything. We were just there because a lot of the reporters that we work with every day were attending the event, and it was an opportunity to meet with them firsthand. All of the meetings we did were actually in the hotel lobby in plain view of the company, their many PR reps that were at the event. And honestly, it was pretty harmless. There wasn't anything threatening, and I don't think it placed Walmart in any danger at all.
And so what did you learn about their monitoring of you?
Well, it was pretty spooky. I wasn't aware that they were monitoring anything until I had heard from Gary McWilliams from the Wall Street Journal, who, you know, calls one day and is looking for a reaction to Walmart's, to a file that Walmart had been collecting, and the fact that Walmart had my personal vacation photos from a couple years ago that I had buried, you know, just deep on a website. They were harmless, nothing. I think I actually, you may have a couple of them yourself, but these pictures, there was nothing incriminating about them, but it is a little eerie to know that that Walmart had a copy of them.
Now, these were on a website online, your photographs of your holiday.
They were. I mean, they were buried deep on a website. It was actually a place I had. I came back from a trip 2 years ago to Vietnam and the Philippines, and I came back and had a fairly large photo file. It was a slideshow, and actually, the reason they were on this website was because my family wanted to view them, and they were too big to email. So I just had been doing some work. I had maintained the site for my employer, and created just a folder. We had plenty of space, created a folder that was not publicly accessible. There were no public links to it, but just created a folder and sent a link around to some friends and family saying, oh, here are my vacation photos. Check them out when you can. So they had been there. They were up there for a little while. Again, there was nothing incriminating about them. So I wasn't terribly worried that they were there. But you know, it's pretty spooky to know that Walmart is interested in them and collecting them.
New Wexler, can you talk about what Walmart Watch does?
Sure. We're a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. We're a coalition of labor, religious, and environmental organizations that are working to try to challenge Walmart to change some of its business practices. You know, ironically, one of the things that we're pushing for is increased transparency for the company. And, you know, events like this make it, you know, sort of underscore the need for more transparency. You know, we're pushing Walmart to, among other things, provide better health care for their employees, make it their employee plan just simply isn't affordable, and many of their employees are forced to go on state Medicaid plans to get coverage for themselves and their family. And Walmart's response has always been, you know, we're operating on small margins, we're retail, we can't afford to do that. But at the same time, you know, they're spending millions of dollars each year on these sophisticated, you know, threat research surveillance operations, and are spending at least $10 million a year on a PR firm in D.C. to handle damage control for events like this. So it's really inconsistent on their part, and we would challenge them. We hope that they would spend the money more on their employee health care system rather than spying and damage control.
I wanted to read an editorial that was posted by Barbara Ehrenreich on the alternate website, mm-hmm. Walmart and Target spy on their employees. It says it reads like a Cold War thriller. The spy follows the suspects through several countries, ending up in Guatemala City, where he takes a room across the hall from his quarry. Finally, after 4 days of surveillance, including some patient ear to the keyhole work, he's able to report back to headquarters that he has the goods on them. They're guilty. But this isn't a John le Carré novel, and the powerful institution pulling the strings wasn't the USSR or the CIA. It was Walmart, and the two suspects weren't carrying plans for a shoulder-launched H-bomb. Their crime was, quote, fraternization. One of them, James Lynn, a Walmart factory inspection manager, was traveling with a female subordinate with whom he allegedly enjoyed some intimate moments behind closed doors. At least the company spy reported hearing moans and sighs within the woman's room. Now, you may wonder why a company so famously cheap that it requires the same-sex teams to share hotel rooms while on the road would invest in international espionage to ferret out mixed-sex fraternizers, unless, as Lynn argues, they were really after him for what is a far worse crime in Walmart's books, openly criticizing the conditions he found in Central American factories supplying Walmart stores. What do you know about this, New Wexler of Walmart Watch?
Well, the Jim Lynn example is particularly scary. I mean, this was a Walmart factory inspector that at the time was writing up a lot of Walmart factories for unsafe working conditions and violations. And as at the same time he was doing that, or soon after he started doing that, you know, Walmart sent this team down there to monitor him and promptly fired him after he started writing up some of these factories. There are other examples. There was another employee, Jared Bowen, who worked for an executive that was fired for, among other things, embezzling corporate funds. Walmart wanted to clean house and get rid of all of these folks. They fired Jared Bowen, one of their employees, who then sued them, and Walmart said, "Oh, we didn't fire you for having anything to do with that scandal. We fired you for lying about your college transcripts," and promptly posted his college transcripts on their website. You know, there are other instances of Walmart monitoring personal emails between employees that aren't on their corporate system, and then this story in the Wall Street Journal sort of blows the lid off of the entire threat research operation. This idea that Walmart is Walmart's program to spy on reporters, shareholders, you know, company critics. They're taking it a little far. I mean, it goes above and beyond, you know, reasonable expectations of corporate security.
And Barbara Ehrenreich goes on to show that link with the New York Times, because it says, in fact, in the Cold War thriller analogy, it's not entirely fanciful. The New York Times reporter Michael Barbaro, who related the story of Walmart's stalking of Lynn and his colleague, also reports the company's security department is staffed by former top officials of the CIA and the FBI. Along the same lines, Jeffrey Goldberg provides a chilling account in the New Yorker. Although instructed not to write down anything he saw, he found a dark, threadbare room when he provides this chilling account of his visit to Walmart's Bentonville War Room. He says he found a dark, threadbare room, its walls painted battleship gray, where only 2 out of 5 of the occupants will even meet his eyes. In general, he found the Bentonville Fortress not unlike the headquarters of the National Security Agency. New Wexler, who are the FBI and CIA officials who work for Walmart?
Well, I mean, the head of Walmart's corporate security operation is a man by the name of Ken Sensor, who ran internal investigations at the CIA for over 10 years. There are other former FBI and CIA agents that they've hired up. You know, I mean, it's sort of at the time the first New York Times eavesdropping scandal broke a couple of months ago, Walmart said, "Oh, this is one rogue employee operating on his own, using his own personal equipment." And I think that smelled funny to a lot of reporters and certainly to us as well. You know, the equipment that was required to do this was very expensive. Some estimates pegged the cost at about $500,000. And some security experts said that it just wasn't possible for somebody to be doing this just on their own. They weren't, hobbyists don't do that. They don't go out and pull text messages and phone conversations off of cell phones out of the air just for fun. What the journal story reveals is that it was part of a much larger operation that now a U.S. attorney in Arkansas is actually looking into to try to figure out what exactly they were doing and whether it was illegal for Walmart to eavesdrop on private citizens.
Now, New Wexler, we weren't able to reach the group Up Against the Wall, another Walmart critic organization. But this issue of infiltrating the group, what do you know about that? Do you have any evidence of that in your own group? And what are you demanding right now?
Well, I mean, we don't have any specific evidence of Walmart infiltrating Walmart Watch. We certainly, when we're interviewing potential job applicants or talking to whistleblowers, are aware of that and certainly, trying to be careful, in that respect. But one of the things, we sent Walmart CEO Lee Scott a letter yesterday asking him whether they had eavesdropped on our organization, whether if we went to Bentonville later on, or in subsequent visits, to Arkansas, whether we would be monitored. We'll probably have a presence at the shareholders meeting in June. We are shareholders. We do have proxy slips for admission.
Where is that meeting?
Walmart holds it every year, not too far from their corporate headquarters in Bentonville. They hold it in the basketball arena at the University of Arkansas down the road in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to sue?
We haven't decided just yet. We've sent a letter to Walmart CEO Lee Scott, asking them what other information they've collected, and we hope they let us know.
New Wexler, I want to thank you for joining us, Communications Great. Director for Walmart Watch. That's based in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, jailed for being sick, we'll go to Arizona to find out why a man who has TB is behind bars. Stay with us. Turn the Centuries Turn by the Stranglers here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on PBS and public access TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Is sickness a crime? We turn now to the case of an Arizona man who's been jailed without committing a single crime. 27-year-old Robert Daniels is being held against his will in a Phoenix hospital ward reserved for sick prisoners. If state officials have their way, he could be there for the rest of his life. Daniels is suffering from a deadly strain of tuberculosis known as XDR-TB. Doctors say he's virtually untreatable. Daniels contracted the disease while living in Russia. He returned to the United States last year, agreed to a voluntary quarantine in residential care, but Daniels violated his agreement when he went outside without a mask. Daniels says he misunderstood how much of a health risk he posed, in part because he hadn't been forced to wear a mask in Russia. Today, Daniels has been forced to live in a hospital cell in complete isolation. His only visitors are medical staff. Sheriff's deputies have taken away his television, his radio, his phone, and his computer. He's under 24-hour surveillance. The light in his room is never turned off, even at night. His only contact with the outside world is a payphone. Daniels recently described his ordeal in a phone interview with the Arizona radio station KJZZ.
I never thought that this could happen. I'm telling you, I'm sometimes sitting on a bed and I'm just crying because of all the quietness. I don't have, you know, a permission to take a normal shower and have to spit wash. It's really cold, especially at this time. I can't even spit wash normally. They're telling me that I'm an inmate. They gave me a booking number, you know, which is for what? For having TB booking number? It's just being all ridiculous. If they want me to be isolated, that's fine with me, but, you know, they don't have the right to isolate me from the other world, especially my family, especially from, you know, the media, the news, the everything. I mean, I'm all alone here. I don't even know what the hell is going on in the world. I'm not being isolated. I'm being incarcerated. I don't have nobody to talk to. I have my mental health is going down. I'm just slowly dying.
Robert Daniels is speaking to the Arizona radio station KJZZ. On Wednesday, Democracy Now! Spoke to a former worker at the Maricopa County Medical Center who has kept in touch with Daniels. She spoke to us on condition that she not be identified and that we disguise her voice.
He says he cries a lot because he's very depressed. You have to understand that he is in what, for all practical purposes, is in solitary confinement. He is in a room in the hospital that, number one, has no hot water, has no privacy, has no natural light. The windows are blocked. He has no visitation. He can make calls, but who can afford to accept to collect their collect calls at 4 o'clock? They turn the telephone on. He doesn't really have magazines. If he does, it's rare. He doesn't have TV. He does not have a radio. So all he has is the quietness of the room and then the nurses coming in when they bring him his medicine. So he cannot take a shower. There are no showers. Right now there are no showers on the floor. But he has not had a shower since January. So he gets nothing for personal hygiene other than a basin of water and some, you know, washcloth. So he's unable to shampoo because his hair, because the faucet in a detention unit is very small, and of course with no warm water in there, he can't shampoo anyway.
That was a former worker at the Maricopa County Medical Center speaking about the tuberculosis patient, Robert Daniels. We also spoke with Daniels' wife, Alla Danilova. She lives in Moscow in Russia with their son, 5-year-old Dmitry. Alla has not seen her husband in over a year.
I would like the government to give him a room without guards, without handcuffs or chains, because he's not a criminal.
Robert Daniels' harsh incarceration has sparked a controversial debate over whether Arizona officials have gone too far in the name of public safety. Dan Pachoda is legal director for the American, Dan Pachoda is American Civil Liberties Union in Arizona, considering taking up Daniels' case. Dan joins us on the phone from Phoenix, and we're also joined by Lawrence Gostin, director of the Center for Law and the Public's Health at Johns Hopkins and Georgetown Universities. On the line with us from Boston is George Annis, a professor of health law at Boston University School of Public Health. I want to begin with Dan Pachoda. Just tell us further what's happening right now and why Robert Daniels is in jail.
Well, as you mentioned, he is in jail because of an initial decision by the county health officials that he required to be quarantined and have his liberty taken away. We are not in position to assess whether that the reasons that underlay that decision made sense in the first instance, but it is clear to us that the conditions that he is being held under, and I do mean held, are not medically dictated, but rather dictated by the sheriff, and that despite clear court cases, he's being held in an unconstitutional and punitive manner, much worse than other persons in the hospital, even persons who have to be isolated, and as admitted by the sheriff's department, like any other jail inmate. He is not a jail inmate, and he will be facing these conditions for many years to come, and they are clearly impacting his mental and physical well-being.
Professor Kosten, can you respond to this situation?
Well, I actually think that was stated quite well. And there's no question that if somebody has extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis, that if it's transmitted to others, it can be very dangerous because the form of infection that you transmit to the other person is similarly very resistant, if not impossible, to treat. And so what you'd be doing is causing really serious harm. And so I think that public health authorities are justified in trying to prevent that, but it needs to be the least restrictive alternative for the shortest amount of time and in decent and humane conditions. Courts have stated that this is not a punitive decision. It shouldn't be. It should be driven by public health and medical authorities, not by police or other corrections officials. And so, in short, the state certainly has a duty to protect the public from extreme health risks, but it needs to do it in a careful, scientific, and humane way.
Professor George Annis of Boston University, what do you think should happen here? Does this case of Robert Daniels surprise you?
Well, it disturbs me more than surprises me. It's not surprising that, you know, when we get the public basically totally ignorant of infectious, contagious diseases, then they're told there's a new disease here that could kill you and it's not treatable. What do you expect? How do you expect people to react, especially people in law enforcement? They're going to react to use the tools they have, and the tools they have are jails and punishment. And Professor Kosten is right. That's wrong. We shouldn't be doing that. We do not want this disease in the United States, although it's clearly here, and we do want to take reasonable measures to make sure that it's not spread in the community. But it does not require locking anybody up in a jail. TB is not that easy to get. I mean, if you hang around in homeless shelters, in prisons, or in places where a lot of people are immunocompromised, like have HIV disease, then it's certainly going to be spread. But just someone walking around, at least if he doesn't go right up next to you and breathe in your mouth for a couple of hours, you're not going to get TB that way. So we have to learn something about tuberculosis as well as something about the inappropriateness and, I think, unconstitutionality of locking people up with the disease.
Professor Kosten, what kind of rights does Robert Daniels have right now? What can he do?
Well, Professor Annis did state it correctly and wisely. There is a constitutional right to humane treatment. The courts have basically said that when there's a civil confinement, whether it's the mentally ill or for reasons of infectious diseases, it needs to be necessary for the public's health. And it is absolutely correct that that TB is not as easily transmissible as the public believes, but it can be transmitted. When that happens, there needs to be humane conditions. It can't be punitive. It can't be in correctional or prison kinds of environments. So you need to give somebody basic, decent, humane care and treatment. It doesn't sound at all like that's the case here, and I would have thought that the courts would be very sympathetic to this. My judgment is that the courts would uphold only the minimal necessary to confine him for the sake of the public, but would not allow an indefinite confinement the way they're proposing, and certainly not in the conditions they're proposing.
Professor Gostin, can you explain what tuberculosis is? What about the outbreak of the 1990s here in New York City? New York forced TB patients to into detention in that outbreak.
Yeah, I mean, it's TB is a bacterial infection. It's very prevalent throughout the world. In fact, one out of every three or four people have tuberculosis infection, but don't get the disease. So only a small number of those will go on to get the disease. It's prevalent in other parts of the world. It exists in the United States, and in the 1990s, in New York and a number of other cities, there was a rise of cases of what they called multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. And more recently, not in the United States particularly, but in other countries like Russia, and South Africa and other places, there's been something called extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis, which means that it really can't even be treated with second and third line medications, and that's what I gather we're talking about here is something that is extremely resistant to treatment, and the reason is that the bacteria just simply adapt to the medications and become resistant and resist them.
So we're talking about a man who's been in prison now for almost, a year, 9-10 months, last July. He was detained. Dan Pakoda, what are the ACLU's plans now in Arizona? Are you going to take up Robert Daniels' case?
We are. The situation has changed over the months. He was initially confined, as was stated, by a civil proceeding in the Arizona State Court. That was brought by the Maricopa County Health Department. And things were okay in terms of the conditions for a while. It was a decision by the Maricopa County Health Department to turn over the body, so to speak, and control of the decisions of most of the routines of Mr. Daniels to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department. And the Sheriff's Department predictably has stated, we will treat this person in our jail ward as any other jail inmate. And flowing from that is the deprivations of loss of things like a TV set and hot water and a computer and any type of music player, a light on in the cell, because things that would be allowed any other patient, no less a patient that has to stay in a room, and no one's disputing the need for a locked room here. We have recently been in touch with the attorney for Mr. Daniels, who was appointed on the initial underlying decision, and we will be working with him to change, at a minimum, the conditions of confinement. As has been stated, it is clearly unconstitutional to hold someone who is civilly committed in this punitive manner. Nothing could be more punitive than the stark conditions facing Mr. Daniels. If necessary, it would be constitutional litigation that we would be involved in.
Well, Dan Pakoda, I want to thank you for being with us of the ACLU in Arizona, Professor Lawrence Gostin and Professor George Annis of Boston University and of Georgetown and Johns Hopkins. Thank you all. That does it for our broadcast on Monday, on Patriots Day in Massachusetts. I'll be with Howard Zinn at Faneuil Hall. You can go to our website for details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Hubert Okuduz, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, who goes on to wonderful future. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.